Hello! Welcome to the normal bank failure episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. Emily Peck of Axios is also here. Elizabeth Spires is here.
Hello.
And yeah, we're going to have a second bank episode in a row. Last week was, you know, recorded before everything went completely pear-shaped. This week is recorded after everything went completely pear-shaped. So we are going to talk about Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, Credit Suisse, First Republic, a little bit of Silvergate. We are going to dive into answering your questions. Thank you for sending them in. We are going to talk about monetary policy. We're going to talk about bank regulation. And basically, we are going to explain what the hell just happened. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So let's jump in with Silicon Valley Bank, which we did cover a little bit on the Slate Plus last week. We talked all about the problem that it had many fewer assets than it did a year ago because interest rates went up and they owned a bunch of mortgage-backed securities. And we were chatting away about how this was potentially a problem for it. And then it went from being potentially a problem to being an existential nightmare ending in its failure within about 5 minutes of our podcast coming out. So, Elizabeth, you wrote about this in the paper of record. What is the big headline here?
So the big headline, I wrote about this because I was an SVB client. I guess I still am, but now it's the SVB Bridge Bank. The big headline is that, so on Thursday the 9th, a lot of people who are SVB clients began pulling their deposits from the bank all at once, and this caused a bank run. And their rationale for doing so was that they believed the bank was insolvent. The bank had invested deposits into longer-term maturities that became problematic when interest rates went up. So no bank is really equipped to deal with people pulling out deposits all at once.
It was $42 billion in one day, which is just an absolutely staggering amount of money. The largest bank run in American history before Silicon Valley Bank was at Washington Mutual in 2008, and that was $16 billion in 10 days. This was $42 billion in one day. We have never seen anything like it. And a bunch of people blamed Twitter, and a bunch of people blamed the fact that, you know, Silicon Valley Bank's depositor base was very small and they all knew each other. And there was a bunch of venture capitalists who all, you know, they were all on the same text threads. But a lot of it was just the fact that there was a relatively small number of depositors in Silicon Valley Bank. And it didn't take that many of them to pull their money out. They happened to have just enormous amounts of money on deposit. One of the weirdnesses of Silicon Valley is that private companies, startups, would keep millions and millions of dollars just on deposit at the bank because they were far too busy, you know, building software or something than to bother to put that money somewhere that it could earn interest. And so, there weren't very many of them. They all knew each other. There was rumors of a bank run. And then the rational thing to do when you hear rumors of a bank run is to get your money out first. And so there was just this enormous bank run.
And then what happened was, so that happened on March 9th, which was Thursday. And by Friday, the bank's stock, trading in the bank's stock was halted. And then the feds take control. The FDIC comes in, shuts down the bank, and everyone heads into the weekend with stomach aches, not knowing what's going to happen, but thinking that the FDIC might find a buyer, which is a typical thing that can happen to a smaller bank. And the question going into the weekend was, what's going to happen to the uninsured deposits at this bank? And what was unusual, as you both have reported is that most of the deposits at the bank were uninsured. They were above the FDIC's $250,000 cap. So the question was like, will the venture capitalists be wiped out? And then, of course, the chatter was, it's not just venture capitalists, it's struggling entrepreneurs, and there's payrolls to think about. And, you know, and then by Monday, the Fed said, everyone is going to, depositors are all going to be made whole, uninsured or not. We're going to do these emergency measures and let people, let banks borrow money from us. And we're going to let banks borrow on the full, Felix will explain this better, but on the full value of their assets.
On the par value of their assets, yeah.
The par value, right. So they went to sell their assets, their securities, and they weren't worth as much as they had said they were on their books, so they had to take a loss. And the Fed is saying, if you just, you don't have to sell, you can just borrow on the par value. So it's kind of a shenanigan, if you ask me.
I don't think it's a shenanigan at all. I think this is exactly what
really?
A macroprudential bank regulator should do. Like, banking by its nature is a public service. It always, you know, shakes hands with the government. The whole reason why people feel safe having their money on deposit at a bank is because they don't need to worry about, like, is my bank credit worthy and that kind of thing. And it is important for banks to be able to lend through a cycle. It is important for banks to be able to make long-term loans, to do this thing called maturity transformation. That is the job of a bank, to borrow short and lend long, to take in these deposits which are callable overnight and then go out and lend them into the business world. It is natural for interest rates to go up and down over the course of that cycle. And it doesn't make sense for banks to be forced to mark all of those assets, their loans, to market according to what interest rates do when they're holding them to maturity and when it is their job to make long-term loans and when they, you know, are going to support their clients through the cycle and get paid back when the maturity of the loan comes due. Now, in this case, it was a little bit different because it wasn't really bank loans. It was just, they were just buying mortgage-backed bonds. But in principle, it's the same thing. And it is the job of the Fed to shore up the banking system. And I wrote about this in my newsletter today, that like what banks do is they lend money and support a whole bunch of non-enormous businesses. If you are one of the 15% of Americans who works for a big S&P 500 publicly listed company, then sure, you know, your company can get by with capital markets and investment banks and bonds and stuff like that. But for everyone else, which is like 85% of employees, those are companies who really require good old-fashioned banking relationships. And the Fed needs to be able to support those banks. And I think they did exactly the right thing.
And a lot of banks took advantage of this on Thursday this week. So a week after everything kind of fell apart, we learned that the Fed lent $153 billion to banks since opening that emergency window, which is a record, I believe. Yeah, way past the peak in the financial crisis. Although I'm not sure that number is adjusted for inflation, but basically what it shows is that banks took advantage and there was a need for the Fed, I think, to do this.
And I think this is also really good as well. Like the Fed has this discount window, right? The whole point of any central bank is that it has to act as a lender of last resort. On Sunday night, the Fed came out and said, we are really leaning into this lender of last resort thing. We're going to reduce the haircut that you need to take when you post collateral to us. We're going to value the collateral at a very generous valuation. And we're really encouraging you to come and use this discount window. And one of the problems was that back in 2008, banks were very reluctant to take advantage of that for reasons that no one entirely understood. And that caused real problems. The good news right now is that banks are not reluctant to go borrow from the discount window. They are doing that. And the stigma, such as it was, that was associated with the discount window does seem to have gone away. And thank Christ, because like this is no time to worry about discount window stigmas.
Okay, but so the Fed announces that clearly banks took advantage. And yet, and for a second, there was sort of like a pause in the crisis mode that the media and the market seemed to be showing us. There was a little pause. And then, nope, it wasn't over yet. It wasn't over yet, right? I mean, things still weren't feeling right yet. So then the next shoe to drop, I guess, bank stocks were still falling, and then Credit Suisse comes into the picture. I mean, this has all happened in 1 week. It's so wild to me.
Yeah, the fact that Credit Suisse decided to pick like this week to implode was just incredibly like unhelpful of it. You know, like Credit Suisse has been slowly imploding for the past 15 years. Like they could have waited another few months. Seriously, guys.
So that kind of happens in the middle of all this. And then the Swiss say, don't worry, we'll loan Credit Suisse some money. So everyone's like, phew, okay. So Credit Suisse is fine. It's not too big to fail.
Credit Suisse is not fine.
But then after that, I think the next day, there's an announcement. First Republic, another regional bank in the U.S., is kind of stumbling. And somehow Janet Yellen got the biggest banks in the country to agree to deposit $30 billion there to shore up those banks.
It's kind of important to note here, too, that First Republic is also a favored bank for early stage tech startups, probably, you know, one of the banks that behind SVB people use a lot.
So it's very similar to SVB.
Yeah. And First Republic, while it doesn't have quite as many uninsured deposits as SVB, certainly has a lot. And First Republic, while it doesn't have quite as much of a bad assets problem. And First Republic is facing the same kind of solvency issues that SVB was, to the point at which it actually did get downgraded to junk this week, which is not something any bank particularly wants. And it's very difficult for like a major bank like First Republic to operate, you know, indefinitely with a junk credit rating. In the short term, it's fine because it has access to that Fed discount window and all the rest of it. But what was interesting to me was that there was this really interesting sort of gathering round of all the big banks in America, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, you name them, they all came along and said, we're going to come up with $30 billion and just put it on deposit at First Republic as a vote of confidence in First Republic. Like this is uninsured deposits and we're just going to put our money on deposit with First Republic because we think that First Republic is a bank that the system needs, and we will do whatever it takes to make sure that it can withstand this mini banking crisis that we're going through. And it was this weird, you know, and almost heartening moment of solidarity in the banking industry, which is often extremely competitive.
Well, I think it was cooperation and self-interest, because I think everyone was terrified that this was going to spiral out of control into a contagion that affected every piece of the banking system, regardless of, you know, what the depositor base has looked like.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that the banks we're worried about here are the regional banks like First Republic and Signature Bank, which also failed on Sunday night, by the way. It's not the big, too big to fail banks, right? So there are a few what's known as G-SIBs, global systemically important banks. So that would include JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citibank, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Bank of New York Mellon. Those are the banks who have seen massive deposit inflows this week because they're too big to fail. Everyone knows that there's no way that any depositors are going to lose money leaving money on deposit with JP Morgan. And it was those banks, the ones who no one is worried about failing, who kind of rescued First Republic. But you are right that just as an industry, it's in everybody's best interest for the banking industry not to have a massive rolling crisis. And it's, you know, and we looked like we'd pretty much smoothed the waters on Sunday night. First Republic wasn't taken over on Tuesday morning. It looks like there wasn't a massive bank run after, you know, the wires went out on Monday that had already been scheduled. But then we had some, you know, other bad news, some of it from Switzerland. Certainly that credit rating downgrade didn't help. And one of the other things that is probably unhelpful is that most of these regional banks, and First Republic is definitely one of them, Silicon Valley Bank as well, and Signature Bank and Silvergate Bank, they were all public. They were publicly listed stocks. And in the absence of any actual information about what's happening to their deposits, people just start looking at the stock price. And banking right now doesn't look very attractive for these regional banks because this, you know, this emergency credit that they're accessing from the Fed is not cheap. Their solvency issues, which we talked about in Slate Plus last week and we've mentioned a little bit this week, you know, are not great. And, you know, it's kind of a natural time for bank stocks to be low right now. And when bank stocks are low and banks are inherently incredibly leveraged, you know, that's what fractional reserve banking is. What that means is that, you know, you can get these kind of terrifying, you know, oh my God, such and such a bank is down 40% today. And then people think that's really bad. And that alone, just the stock price, can cause a bank run. And that is like a really unfortunate sort of death spiral mechanism. And I kind of wish that a lot of these banks weren't public right now for exactly that reason.
Felix, one thing you said that I've been thinking about a lot that I hope we could unpack maybe is that too big to fail banks, I mean, they come out of this looking really good and they saw, you know, more money flowing to them and they stepped in to even save another bank, you know, very like 1907 JP Morgan vibes there because he famously, the banker back then, got other banks into a room and force them to save, to do a bank rescue, you know? Anyway, it seems like too big to fail is good now.
Right. I know, doesn't it? Yeah.
Am I missing something? But it's not supposed to be. Like, I'm really flummoxed by this because in the US, it seemed like it was a kind of good thing. Like, everyone was like, well, at least the big banks are safe because they're too big to fail and that's great. And everyone put their money there, whatever. Then overseas at the same time, you see this Swiss bank, Credit Suisse, which has just been like mired in controversy and scandal and like is obviously not well managed or hasn't been well managed, get rescued by the Swiss government. And you're like, wait, that's why we don't like too big to fail. So I don't know how to think about too big to fail anymore.
Right. So the way to think about too big to fail is that, you know, some banks really are too big to fail. There are 30 of them. You can look up the list. It's on the internet. And when you have that designation, when you have that official G-SIB designation, you have to operate under very, very strict, ultra-enhanced scrutiny of bank regulators, both domestically and internationally, for precisely the reason that you are too big to fail. No one can allow you to fail. Like, it is literally impossible for Credit Suisse to just fail. So when push comes to shove, the Swiss National Bank had no choice but to lend it another 50 billion Swiss francs because it's too big to fail. And everyone knew that was going to happen. Now, what happens to the stock price? We don't know. What happens to like the COCOs, which I don't know, we've talked about on the show before, the contingent convertible debt, that kind of stuff. We don't know. But the bank itself has to go on because it is just too big and just too interconnected to fail. And therefore, it has to operate under this very sort of strict scrutiny from its regulators, just as the big banks in the US have to operate under strict scrutiny from their regulators. We are now living in this post-2008 era of what's known as like Basel III and macroprudential blah, 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 which basically means that the kind of crazy leverage that those too big to fail banks had back in 2006, 2007, no one's allowed to do that anymore.
Well, one question is, was SVB or First Republic, should they have been too big to fail too? Because clearly the Fed said they pose a systemic risk. So why weren't they also designated in that way is sort of a question that
Well, they were small enough to fail and Silicon Valley Bank did fail. That's the difference, right? Silicon Valley Bank, Quay Bank, was not bailed out, but Silicon Valley Bank failed. Okay. All of its shareholders were wiped out. All of its executives were fired. All of its bondholders were pretty much wiped out. You know, we, as of this taping, don't know whether it's going to survive. We assume that bits and pieces will get sold to someone or other. But like, yeah, it's a failed bank, just like Washington Mutual was a failed bank. Like, you're allowed, those banks are small enough to fail.
Well, then it doesn't, just to go back to too big to fail being quote unquote good now, it doesn't seem that good to me if like JP Morgan and Chase has, like Jamie Dimon's making millions and millions and millions of dollars and his company is basically backed by the US government. It's like quasi-nationalized, is it not?
Yes. Yeah, it is. And this is totally understood. And they have to pay like an extra fee basically to the government in order to make up for that. And it is understood that, you know, the provision of credit, like, what, you know, is a fundamental part of what drives any economy, right? Banks create money. Mm-hmm. If you want to start, you know, going into the really boring, like, mechanisms of, like, how money growth happens and that kind of stuff. Like, without banks, the economy doesn't work, and certain banks are too big to fail. And it just, like, it is possible to imagine some incredibly egalitarian banking system where there are 1,000 banks and all of them are small enough to fail and there aren't any which are too big to fail, right? Like, in principle, that might be possible. Like, remember the slogan back in the financial crisis that used to hear every so often of break up the banks, right? They're too big. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that even if you did break them up into, like, any sensible kind of constituent parts, right? You shave off the investment bank from the commercial bank. You shave off, like, you know, this bit from that bit. Like, even then, the commercial bank heart of it remains too big to fail, right? There's no country in the world that has a lot of small enough to fail banks. There's no country in the world that has a lot of small enough to fail banks and no too big to fail banks. It just doesn't exist in the wild. In an ideal world, perhaps we can think that that would be great, but, like, I've never seen it anywhere.
Yeah, this also kind of essentially illustrates the increasingly public nature of the banking sector. You know, it's completely dependent on government guarantees and government charter, yeah. But we talk about it like it's entirely private.
It's totally not entirely private, right? I don't know if you've noticed this, right? But whenever there's a bank ad on Slate Money, we always say at the end, member FDIC, right? It's like the first, it's actually like something you have to do if you're advertising yourself as a bank or if you're presenting yourself as a bank, is to tell everyone, like, we are working with the government here. The FDIC is the government. This is a partnership with the government. And the reason you can feel safe depositing your money with us is precisely because the government is guaranteeing your money. Banks everywhere, by necessity, are always a public utility. And they always are regulated by the government and and a quasi-public, as you put it in that way. Like, this, there is nothing new in here, and in fact, it has to be that way. So sure, let's take a break. And we have some questions. You guys have been amazing at asking us questions via email, slatemoney@slate.com. So let's maybe answer some of those after the break.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, so let's answer some questions. Marcus wrote in and said, I was wondering about the ownership of SVB now. I understand the government has backstopped deposits. Is SVB now owned by the government, and what does that really mean? Short answer is yes. We have nationalized SVB. It is now... Elizabeth, what did you say it was called? Silicon Valley Bridge Bank?
That's a technical Silicon Valley Bridge Bank.
The idea being that this is like a bridge bank that won't last very long and eventually is going to get sold to someone else. And then when it's sold to, let's say it's sold to, I don't know, Barclays, then it will just become part of Barclays and it won't exist anymore. It'll just be, you know, Barclays at that point. But for the time being, we have a U.S. government-owned bank called Silicon Valley Bridge Bank. There's also another U.S. government-owned bank in New York, which is running what used to be Signature Bank. And this is what happens when banks fail, is the FDIC comes in and basically nationalizes them. This is good, right?
Yeah, in the case of Silicon Valley Bridge Bank, the government's basically guaranteeing all deposits for a year. And I think they're assuming that they'll be able to find a buyer sometime during that period.
I was remembering when I was growing up, I guess that was back during the time, I wouldn't know this because I was too young, but it was during the time of the savings and loan crisis, and like hundreds and hundreds of banks failed. And I remember going to the bank and the FDIC or whoever, I don't know, had, you know, taken over, and there was like a new sign taped up over the old sign of whatever the bank used to be called. It used to be pretty common. But it hasn't been post-crisis to see a bank fail and get taken over. So I think people may have forgotten kind of how it works and how the FDIC knows what it's doing, you know?
Marcus continues and says, why would the government have to take it over if the deposits are backstopped? Couldn't the bank just use this new Fed program to borrow all the money it needs to pay the outflow of deposits? Another good question. It is one of those cases, and you see this quite a lot in finance, where like you solve the problem going forwards for every other bank. So if you're First Republic or if you're PacWest, you get to take advantage of this program. But if you're the bank that like caused the problem in the first place, then no, so you don't get that special treatment. You just get intervened and taken over. Barney Frank was on the board of Signature Bank, and this was one of the things he said. He's like, if you're going to announce this incredible, you know, Fed window, then Signature Bank wouldn't need to fail, right? We could just borrow everything we needed from the Fed. And he's not wrong, but the regulators have made it clear that they kind of didn't like Signature Bank, partly because it was very involved in crypto, partly because there were other controls that they thought were missing, and they just didn't feel like they trusted Signature Bank enough to allow it that privilege of accessing this extraordinary Fed window, so they just took it over instead.
Are we going to do a whole sidebar about Barney Frank?
Sure. What do you want to say about Barney Frank?
Well, I would like to say that Barney Frank is the Frank in Dodd-Frank, the much-hated financial regulation bill that made Too Big to Fail official. And anyway, it's a get-tough-on-banks kind of a bill, as people probably know, and Barney Frank's name is on it. What people didn't really realize is that after he retired from the Senate, he wound up on the board of this bank, Signature Bank, which got a lot of its deposits from the crypto industry. And back in 2018, when Trump was in office and they wanted to roll back some of Dodd-Frank, Barney Frank went back to Congress and said, this will be fine. And he was also on the board of a bank when he said it. And it's just sort of interesting what happens to legislators after they leave Congress. That is the side note about Barney Frank.
Yeah, there was an interview with him with New York Magazine, I think, and he was complaining about the takeover because he says the DFS, New York's regulatory authority, didn't actually say that Signature was insolvent. And he also argues that, they didn't have that many crypto depositors, but that seems disingenuous when crypto was 30% of their deposit base. So even if it was two or three, what does it matter? I mean, and what do you think about the insolvency argument?
I don't think it matters, right? One of the important parts of what we're talking about with this very close relationship between banks and regulators that is necessary in a world, you know, of government deposit insurance, is that the regulators don't have like a very strict set of criteria that all needs to get ticked off before they intervene and take over a bank. They can do it with any bank for any reason. And with Signature, they were just like, okay, this is too much for whatever reason. And they haven't spelled out their reasons and they don't need to spell out their reasons. But they have made it clear that in this auction for Signature Bank that they're now running, and they're trying to find someone to buy it, they fully expect the new buyer of Signature Bank to not bank any of those crypto companies. So the crypto accounts are basically not included in the auction.
Yeah, the other industry that I think they have a lot of heavy concentration in is commercial real estate, particularly in New York. My ex-boss, Jared Kushner, I think had accounts there.
Interestingly, there is one other industry where they're very, very big. They're by far the biggest banker to Broadway. So if you want Broadway shows to keep on going strong, we have to hope that Signature Bank finds a sympathetic buyer who understands how Broadway works. It's one of those things where, like, there are certain industries where just bankers really understand that industry, and just so happens that Signature really understands Broadway. It also, by the way, lost a whole bunch of money lending money against taxi medallions in New York City. That's another weird business that it got into that it probably shouldn't have got into.
What's the next question, Felix?
Marcus had one last bit. He said, is there a limit to how many banks the government would take ownership of? Would the government do this for a larger bank if conditions became worse? No and yes. Like, as we saw in savings and loan, you know, there is no limit. And one of the reasons why the FDIC did what it did and the full extent of deposits were guaranteed, not just the insured deposits, but also the uninsured deposits, is precisely that it would be more expensive for the FDIC to only insure deposits up to $250,000 than it is to do what they did. If they made it clear with Signature Bank and with Silicon Valley Bank that beyond $250,000 you are on your own, that would cause a huge bank run at thousands of banks across the entire country. Hundreds of banks, like at least a couple of hundred banks would end up failing. And that would be more expensive for the FDIC than just insuring everything at SVB. So this is, if you want the details on that, you can look up Friday's at Axios Markets, where I went into detail about that.
Now we're in this weird world where everyone kind of woke up to the fact that deposits over $250,000 are not insured. And there's sort of like a new worry about those deposits, which is leading some people to, or some companies maybe, or some money to flee from the smaller banks to the bigger banks, where it's still true that money over $250,000 or more wouldn't be insured, but they're too big to fail. So maybe it's safer to put your uninsured deposits there. Thus, like, feeding kind of some kind of like doom loop cycle for the smaller banks. What do you think of that?
So there's a couple of things going on. That's definitely happening. But also, like, there's no good reason for anybody to have more than $250,000 on deposit. The deposit rates are not particularly attractive, right? You can keep your money in like treasury bills, which are just as liquid as a deposit account, and you can earn 5% on that. There are also things called ICS, cash sweeps. There's a company called InfraFi, which used to be called
Promontory that you know will allow you to insure millions and millions of dollars, you know, rather than just $250,000. They do clever things where they slice up the deposits and like put it in a bunch of different banks, and you just deal with one bank. There's a lot of ways to keep millions of dollars insured or, you know, safe. And what kind of befuddles me, I have to admit, is why so many companies had so much cash, have so much cash just sitting on deposit with banks. Silicon Valley Bank like was a kind of outlier on this, that you had these startups and these venture capital companies just having millions of dollars in the bank because they were, you know, Silicon Valley and that's what they do. But even through the rest of the country, you know, roughly 50% of deposits at basically every bank in the country are uninsured. And it always kind of befuddles me why anyone would have any uninsured deposits, especially when, you know, treasury bills are yielding so much.
I mean, I don't think anyone realized, maybe this is wrong, but it didn't seem like the people realized the risk at play with the uninsured deposits. There was like a feeling of safety.
Yeah, we did, you know, there was this one of the problems, and honestly, this was kind of the biggest problem with Silicon Valley Bank, and the reason why it caused more of a crisis than really it should have done is that it failed on a Friday mid-morning rather than failing on a Friday afternoon, which is when banks normally fail. The way the FDIC normally works is it comes in on a Friday afternoon after the bank closes. They wrap everything up, and by Monday morning, it's reopened under a new brand, under a new shingle, under new ownership. You know, the shareholders are wiped out, the management has been replaced, but like no one spends a weekend panicking about whether they're going to be able to make payroll. What happened here was that you had the intervention by the FDIC on Friday morning, and then for all of Friday and all of Saturday and nearly all of Sunday, you had a whole bunch of people going, oh my God, what if I can't make payroll? Oh my God, I've just lost all my money. Oh my God, I'm panicking. And that panic started spreading beyond just Silicon Valley Bank to everyone who had more than $250,000 in their bank account. In the end, you know, it was fine. The government stepped in and said, listen, you're fine. You're completely insured. Even if you have over $250,000 in SVB or signature, they've sent as strong of a signal as they possibly could that, you know, if you're also at First Republic or PacWest, then you also don't need to worry. And, you know, they had to do that because of all of that panic. If they'd only been able to wait until Friday afternoon to, you know, close down SVB, then there probably would have been almost much, much less panic, I would say.
Next question.
Next question from Damien. Basically, what should SVB have done with the asset side of its portfolio? You know, they bought all of these mortgage-backed bonds, and the bonds went down in value, and they became insolvent, and then there was a bank run. So that was bad. What should they have done? Basically, the answer there is manage your interest rate risk. Like the San Francisco Fed, you know, should have been much more on top of it. That was their main bank regulator, and they should have been much more on top of it, and they weren't. And certainly a Silicon Valley Bank should have been much more on top of it, and they weren't. They went 8 months without a chief risk officer. That's like a really bad look. It was known within the bank that they were taking a bunch of interest rate risk, and this was very risky. And so it was known within their regulator that this was very risky. And somehow they managed to keep on doing it, and they were allowed to keep on doing it. And that was a regulatory failing, and that was a management failing. And they should not have taken that risk, and it is not necessary to take that kind of risk. You can make floating rate loans instead of fixed rate loans. You can do interest rate swaps. You can do lots of things. You can just put your money on deposit at the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve will pay what's known as interest on excess reserves, IOER. There are lots of things you can do with your assets which don't involve buying long duration mortgage bonds. Come on, people.
Yeah, when the bank failed, it had, you know, reported that it was in the process of restructuring its portfolio for shorter term instruments and hedging with swaps. So, you know, it sort of raises the question of why they didn't do it sooner.
Yeah, the reason they didn't do it sooner was, you know, they got a little bit greedy, but yeah, no, it was a terrible, terrible move. And we have a question from P.T. Withington saying the FDIC will make up any losses to the insurance fund essentially by levying an assessment on all banks. So I wonder if that will make all banks a little more circumspect about the pursuit of profit at the risk of their depositors. No, I think is the answer. Like, I don't think that banks think that way. And as I say, like, if you look at what the FDIC did, they basically prevented a bank run. They prevented losses to the insurance fund by saying everything is insured. It's a bit, what's the word? Paradoxical. But the more they insure, the less they need to pay out in insurance. Because if your deposits are fully insured, then you don't need to withdraw them. And if you're not withdrawing them, if you're just keeping them on the bank, at the bank, then the FDIC doesn't need to pay anything out. Emily, you got another question via text message about central banking.
Yes, it's a really good question, I think. As a Slate Money listener, I would like to hear whether the Fed moves this week could be construed as quantitative easing and how that is likely to impact its mandate to bring down inflation and restore price stability. In other words, what the heck? The Fed is now lending out all this money to banks at a time when it's supposed to be not doing that, when it's supposed to be taking money out of the system, it's supposed to be bringing down inflation. And our colleague Neil Irwin, I believe, has a piece out about this on Friday as well. But I'm curious what you think, what you guys think.
I think not yet. I don't think that, this week's activity has been, large enough or aggressive enough to constitute QE again.
I would say quite the opposite. I'd say that we've actually had tightening. That what the Fed tries to do when it raises interest rates is make people more reluctant to borrow money and make banks more reluctant to lend money. Because if they lend money out, they're going to have to do it at a higher interest rate, which is going to be harder to repay. And, they're going to have bigger credit losses. And they try and sort of take the economy off the burner, as it were, like try and get things to cool down a bit. What the banking industry as a whole just did is basically tighten credit conditions. Banks are in no mood to be lending out money right now. Borrowers are in no mood to be borrowing money right now. We just have much less credit now than we did a week ago. We have much less appetite for credit on the demand side. We have much less appetite for credit on the supply side. And for those reasons, the Fed kind of doesn't need to hike as much as it had thought, perhaps, because this banking crisis has had the effect of, probably a 25, 50 point basis point hike right there. That's my theory.
Yeah.
Far from this being QE, this is like QT, this is tightening that we're seeing.
Yeah, the Goldman had a similar note that what the banking crisis means is that the Fed has to do less rate hiking now because there'll be a natural pullback in lending and, I guess, spending because of what happened, which is really interesting, which would kind of offset whatever money the Fed lent out, right? Because lending out money isn't the same thing as quantitative easing, buying bonds. It's different, yes?
Yeah, and exactly. And the Fed, remember that the Fed is only lending it to banks, right? If you lend that money to a bank, that and $2.75 will get you on the subway, right? Like, that doesn't actually affect the real economy. In order for that to have any effect on the real economy, the banks then need to turn around and re-lend that money out to individuals and businesses. And that's the big question. And I don't see any indication that's happening.
I mean, up until this past week, all the economists, everyone watching the Fed had been saying, like, those guys are going to break something. They're raising rates too fast. Something's going to break, And like the Elizabeth Warrens of the world were saying, people are going to be unemployed. All the people are going to be thrown out. They're going to lose their jobs. But that hadn't really been happening except, in the tech industry. And then now we see what broke, which was the banking industry. And that might have the same impact as raising unemployment would on inflation, right?
No, I think that's absolutely right. Okay, I think that's your questions answered. Let's talk a little bit more about central banks and monetary policy after this break.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
There is another super interesting question about central banks related to this crisis, Emily, which you wrote about this week, which is that the Federal Reserve is not only in charge of monetary policy, it's also the top main bank regulator in America. And specifically for Silicon Valley Bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco was the main regulator of SVB. And that feels like a weird kind of tension. In fact, the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank, Greg Becker, was on the board of the San Francisco Fed. On when it comes to things like the San Francisco Fed needs to know about the innovation economy in Silicon Valley, and no one knows that better than the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank, that makes sense. But like, it also creates this insane conflict where he's on the board of his own regulator.
Yeah, I mean, the Fed is not looking good coming out of this, and I'm not the only one saying it by a long shot. So the immediate criticism is, you know, Silicon Valley Bank had regulators sitting at the San Francisco Fed, bank examiners who are supposed to keep an eye on what it's doing and be like, hey guys, interest rates they're going up. Like, look at all this stuff on your balance sheet. This is bad. Like, you got to fix this. Like, that should have been going on behind the scenes. There's a story out in Bloomberg last week that suggested it was going on. But even if it was going on, nothing really changed. And then there's this other kind of controversy brewing because the guy at the main Federal Reserve named Randall Quarles got a lot of attention during the Trump years for saying he wanted to take a new approach when it came to bank examination. He was criticized for taking a friendly approach to bank examination. Some would say a more lax approach, et cetera. You know, he would say, no, I'm just trying to, he told me he was just trying to establish a due process. So, you know, bank examiners would, the way they work with the banks made more sense and there was due process and fairness involved, but that really hasn't stemmed the criticism. So it's not only the San Francisco Fed that's being criticized, it's also the Fed, because while they're not doing the actual examining of the bank, they're sort of setting the policies and telling the regionals how to do the examining, if that makes sense. They set the tone.
I will say it could be worse, right? Like, it could be the Swiss National Bank trying to regulate Credit Suisse. And if anyone has, like, if there's been a massive regulatory failure anywhere, it has to be that one, because Credit Suisse, as we talked about, is too big to fail. It's a G-SIB. In America, at least, we haven't had any G-SIBs run into trouble. Credit Suisse is just this bottomless pit of scandals and bribery and money laundering and tax evasion and Greensill and Archegos and you name it. That, you know, whatever illegal activity you can think that a bank might have ever done, Credit Suisse has been found guilty of and has been fined for. And now they just came out and said, oh, and by the way, like, our last 2 years of accounts have material misstatements in them, and we don't actually know how much money we made or lost in 2021 or 2022. And you're like, come on, people. Like, when you are that big, when you are that systemically important, you have to have your act together. And it is really the Swiss central bank's job to ensure that Credit Suisse has its act together, and they have clearly failed.
I mean, is there a mechanism? I mean, I understand on some level too big to fail, but there has to be a mechanism to be like, okay, we're calling it. You failed. This is bad. We need to start over. Like, can't the Swiss do something? It seems like Credit Suisse has run out of chances. Like, and what happens in the U.S. if some similar kind of crisis roils, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman or whatever? Can the regulators come in and be like, look, I know I said you were too big to fail, but, you know, you should probably go out of business. Like,
I think in theory, the too big to fail banks here, though, you know, that it would be an incremental process where they get fined and, you know, there are penalties all the way up to that. So it seems unlikely that it would get that bad. right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the one that we talked about last week, right, was Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is a G-SIB. Wells Fargo has a long series of management failures and oversights and criminal behavior. And it is operating under a consent decree right now. You know, it's not allowed to increase its deposit base. It's operating under a strict deposit cap. And yeah, the Federal Reserve and the other regulators are taking a very, very, very close interest in Wells Fargo and basically saying you can't so much as go to the bathroom without asking us for permission first. And, you know, that's kind of what you want to see, right? I mean, should they have been taken over? Should they have been failed? Should the shareholders have been zeroed out? Should the management have been fired? Well, you know, the fact is that virtually every single member of senior management who oversaw, you know, that fake account scandal was pushed out, you know. And who were they pushed out by? Not the board. It was by the Fed.
Right. And one of them now is Carrie Tolstad, I believe, is yep. facing possible prison sentence, which would be...
And she just got fined $19 million, I think, which is, you know, even mm-hmm. by Wall Street standards, $19 million is a pretty big amount of money. I think we should have a numbers round. There have been a lot of numbers this week, but Elizabeth, you have one.
So my number is 50, and that's the number of bank accounts an NBA superstar whose nickname is the Greek Freak. His name is Giannis Antetokounmpo. Open 50 bank accounts, with each one holding $250,000 exactly because of the FDIC deposit limit. And this is an old story, but it's from last year.
Someone tell him about InfraFi, really. Like, you can do this thing called ICS, cash sweep. The solution to the problem of there is only $250,000 in, you know, federal guarantee per bank account is not to open 50 bank accounts in 50 different banks, people. Like, that is the wrong answer to that problem.
I think this guy was just scarred from living in the Greek economy for so long and then came here and said, this seems safe. I'll do this.
Good problem to have, if you ask me.
My number is 5, which is the number of years ago that Joseph DiPaolo, the CEO of Signature Bank, said this. So this was 5 years ago. He said, in 5 years, a number of banks will not be around because of blockchain technology. He totally nailed it. This is like such an Oracle at Delphi moment, you know? he called his own death without realizing
it. His bank's not around.
Exactly.
To be clear, his bank is not around Amazing. Because of blockchain technology.
Yeah.
Do you want to know my number?
Yeah.
My number is 64. I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to what's going on in France, but 64 is now the new retirement age there, and it comes after the French president, Emmanuel Macron, forced through raising the retirement age from 62 to 64, causing all manner of protest and strikes and just people just raging over this change. He tried to get a vote for it in French Parliament. He wasn't going to have a vote. And there's a mechanism apparently in the French Constitution where you can like force through measures. He basically put his whole administration on the line so he could raise the retirement age in France. Again, from 62 to 64, which I'm just fascinated by because I'm an American and I believe that I will never retire. Although, of course, you can take Social Security starting at 62. But anyway, I don't know how you guys, if you guys have been following it or have feelings, but it's just the most French thing to me ever.
No, it is gloriously French, right? Like going out on the street and protesting because like you want to retire at 62 and now the French government won't let you retire until you're 64. It's mm-hmm. yeah, like I love European strikes in general and French strikes in particular, but this is a wonderful thing to strike over. And Americans would never strike over this, right? Americans would never protest over this because in America, like everyone feels like it's good and noble to work. And this is, and in France, clearly they're like, it's good and noble to retire as early as possible. And I kind of like that.
Yes. I feel like Americans both love Social Security, but yeah, they wouldn't actually take to the streets and set fires to anything or do anything wild
set
over
fire
this.
Plus, in, you know, FIRE, FIRE, financial independence, retire early. That's Now the French are going to start adopting that. So I want to have a Slate Plus segment where we talk to Elizabeth Spires about her Silicon Valley bank account, or her Silicon Valley bank account, I should say. That's going to come up. But for the rest of us, thank you for listening to Slate Money. Thank you very much to Patrick Fort and to Anna Phillips for producing. Thank you for sending in all of those questions via email, which we didn't even need to ask you to do because you guys know us by now. SlateMoney@slate.com. And yeah, we'll be back next week with more Slate Money.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.